Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how the murky underworld of the global arms trade compromises democracy and security. Then, the International Criminal Court has sentenced a Congolese militia leader, completed its second conviction since the court was founded 12 years ago. We'll explore why the court has so few convictions and what can be done to strengthen prosecution of international crimes. The global arms trade is a murky world where the legal transactions meet the black and gray markets, according to our next guest. It's a world of corruption, deceit, and death that is largely conducted underground, he says. And it accounts for more than $1.5 trillion of spending worldwide. There are also hidden costs to the arms trade, costs to democracy, to society, and ironically, to national security, he says. Andrew Feinstein is a former member of parliament in South Africa, a fellow at the Open Society Institute, and the founding co-director of Corruption Watch. His book is called The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade. Welcome, Andrew Feinstein.
Thank you very much.
You said that you started this book as a result of some observations you made while an MP in South Africa. What were those observations?
I was very privileged to serve under Nelson Mandela in the first democratic government in South Africa. But as Mandela was retiring, South Africa decided to spend what will ultimately amount to around $10 billion on weapons that the country didn't need and barely uses today. And the reason for that transaction was primarily the $300 million of bribes that were paid on the deal. And in addition to that, which came at huge socioeconomic costs, this was at the time that Mandela's successor, Thabo Mbeki, was saying that we didn't have the fiscal resources to provide life-saving medication to the over 5 million people living with HIV and AIDS. But it was also the point at which the ANC, Mandela's party, started to lose its moral compass. And ironically, some of the people who had played a crucial role in bringing democracy to South Africa were prepared to undermine the very institutions of that democracy that they'd created in order to ensure that the truth about this deal didn't come out into the public domain. And so it made me realize the role that this arms trade plays in the process of governance and politics. And I realized that this wasn't unique to South Africa or even Africa, that this was a global phenomenon.
How were you able to conduct this research?
Well, I was very fortunate. It's a very difficult area to research because a lot of it is kept secret in terms of national security imperatives. But national security is used to hide what is often just quite criminal behavior or very poor policy choices by government. But in my case, because of my experience in South Africa, when I moved to the UK after resigning from Parliament about 10 years ago, investigators, prosecutors, investigative journalists, whistleblowers who were working on the arms trade globally approached me because of my experience in South Africa. And that provided me with a network. It provided me with access to a lot of investigative materials and a lot of archives that hadn't been in the public domain. And this really gave me the basis for the research that went into the book.
In terms of the secret data?
Yes. There was a lot of material. So to give you just one example, I write a lot about a network of illegal or illicit arms dealers that started with a group of former senior Nazi officers in post-war Germany that created a network that has gone on for decades and decades and decades, involved in some of the worst of the illegal arms deals that have been conducted in the post-war period. And I managed to get hold of an archive that was collected in an attempt to try one of these arms dealers, a guy who'd been very involved in Liberia with the then dictator Charles Taylor. This guy was in jail in Italy for almost 5 years. Huge investigations were done around the world. And as so often happens in this trade, which operates in something of a parallel legal universe, say the laws that apply to you and I somehow don't seem to apply to this industry. And his trial was stopped virtually before it started, with a high court claiming Italy had no jurisdiction over him, which was an astonishingly inept judicial decision. But the chief of police who'd investigated this guy for many years allowed an investigator to copy this huge archive of material, and the investigator made it available to me. So I was able to use information that had never been in the public domain. A lot of it was secret.
The numbers are astounding.
The numbers are terrifying. I mean, first of all, our governments spend about $1.6 trillion a year on defense, with the U.S. spending almost as much as the rest of the world combined. But almost as astonishing is the reality that this trade in weapons accounts for almost 40% of all corruption in all world trade.
There are some particular companies, such as Lockheed Martin and BAE, that you really focus on. Why don't we start with the United States and with perhaps Lockheed Martin and that relationship, especially with the Bush administration, the Reagan administration, and what has happened since then?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the U.S. is the dominant player because of how much it spends on national defense and national security. All in all, in terms of national security, in 2010, the U.S. spent around $1 trillion. Because of this position and the amount of weaponry that it produces, primarily through companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, it has a very, very prominent role in the world. What is crucial to understand here is that while I tried initially to write two separate narratives, one of the so-called formal trade, the sort of government-to-government trade, which involves the big players, the companies I'm mentioning, and companies like BAE Systems in the United Kingdom. And then I was going to write separately about the illicit trade or the black market in weapons. And the reality is that I discovered that they are so intertwined that it was impossible to write two almost distinct narratives. And the U.S. really encapsulates that, because during the 60s, the 70s, and parts of the 80s, these U.S. companies perhaps paid more bribes, were involved in more corrupt activity than any others in the global arms trade. But then U.S. legislators started toughening up legislation, particularly the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It was implemented far more stringently. So from the late 80s through the 90s until today, the U.S. is engaged in less overt corruption and bribery in international export deals than, say, a lot of European countries, and certainly than a lot of Chinese or Russian companies. But the thing that stands out for me about the U.S. are really two things. The first is the way in which the domestic weapons procurement system takes place, the way in which these large companies sell incredibly expensive weapon systems to the U.S. military. And what I've realized is that this is really a circle of patronage that takes place between the large defense contractors, the Pentagon, where we had, for instance, in 2010, 84% of senior officials in the Pentagon who took retirement in 2010 went into senior executive positions with defense contractors. So in other words, with the companies to whom they had been awarding contracts during their careers in the military. And therefore, a lot of their careers are spent ensuring that their relationships with these companies are extremely good. And then the lawmakers who have to approve these projects in Congress, defense contractors are huge contributors to political campaigns. And, of course, they promise jobs in almost every congressional district in the country on the big, most expensive weapons projects. And some of these jobs are really no more than a few people sitting around a table doing nothing in particular, sometimes surfing the internet. But it makes it incredibly difficult for a lawmaker to oppose any of these systems. So this results in situations like we have in the U.S., where the American taxpayer is having to foot the bill for the most expensive jet fighter ever produced, something called the F-35, that will cost a minimum of $382 billion for a jet plane that would have been very useful during the Cold War, but is virtually irrelevant to the sorts of conflict that the U.S. is currently engaged in, and according to U.S. intelligence agencies, is likely to be engaged in for generations to come. These sorts of projects simply aren't affordable in the economic environment that the U.S. and the rest of the world finds itself in. So the domestic procurement system itself, I believe, is deeply problematic. And choices are made, like the F-35, that actually undermine national security rather than strengthen it. And then the other thing that really struck me about the U.S. is that a lot of the worst of the illicit or illegal dealers that I investigate, for instance, a Lebanese Armenian based in Beirut who has been involved in a lot of the worst arms transactions of the last 40 years, selling into all of the countries that have UN embargoes on them, selling into conflicts that the US, for instance, spends an enormous amount of money trying to resolve. Now, someone like this then turns up in Iraq and Afghanistan as a contractor to the US Department of Defense and to major US defense contractors, and even to USAID in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the African state of Liberia. And I find this sort of hypocrisy, these sorts of double standards, where the U.S. on the one hand is trying to ensure that its own companies are less engaged in corruption and bribery, but then utilizes at great cost a whole lot of illegal arms dealers who it should actually be bringing to justice, not using for its own war efforts in conflict.
You mentioned this Armenian-Lebanese man, Joe Derhov Sepian.
Correct.
You said that he was involved in some of these most illicit deals. I'd like you to describe some of them first. But also, you noted that intelligence agents are engaged in this network. And so they must know. Let's talk about him and his transactions. And then who knows this and why you think it continues?
I read about this chap in a Commission of Inquiry report, but had never heard of him and could find no record of him. And bizarrely, after over a year of searching for him, I eventually found him on Facebook. And after months and months of pestering him, his first email in response to my communication said, "In my long life, I've never done anything for nothing. Why should I start now?" And I just sent him a stream of emails over a period of months and months, and flattering him and telling him that everyone I spoke to told me he knew more about the trade than anybody else alive. And eventually, out of the blue, I got a call from him, and he said, "Come and meet me in my office in Amman, Jordan on Sunday," at one of his many offices around the world, and we'll chat. And he outlined to me how he'd started his career with this network of former Nazis, and that's where he'd really got his start in the arms trade. He, like many modern arms dealers, would sell to both sides in a conflict. He, for instance, they were involved in Egypt when it was still a monarchy. They sold to King Farouk when he was overthrown by General Nasser, who was the ideological opposite of the monarchy. They just continued selling to Nasser. He was very involved in selling to a whole range of sides in the Balkans conflict, even though there was a UN arms embargo on the conflict. He sold extensively into Africa, breaking various arms embargoes there. He traded with apartheid South Africa, and in fact, he would sell weapons to the Balkan countries that he would source from apartheid South Africa, which is how he came to be involved in this commission of inquiry. But again, a lot of involvement with American and other intelligence agencies, which is how he stays out of any sort of legal trouble. And I would say to him, "Are you sure this is on the record?" And he laughed and he said, "Do you think after a career of over 40 years that if they wanted me in jail, I'd still be sitting here a free man?" So the reality is that our intelligence agencies use these sorts of people as intelligence assets, sometimes to do deals for them. For instance, this Nazi network was actually established with the help of post-war German intelligence and the CIA, who assisted them in their early deals, which were in the early years of the Cold War, deals that America and Germany couldn't be seen to be doing themselves. So they used these sort of people to do them, and then would continue to use them as intelligence assets over a period of time, even though these people often sell weaponry to America's sworn enemies. But the intelligence relationships continue, and it's something that I find quite extraordinary. And it's why these people are so often protected. And there is the case of the Russian arms dealer, sometimes referred to as the Merchant of Death, although he's one of hundreds, if not thousands, who do similar things. A chap called Victor Boot, who was convicted of gun running that endangered American lives in a New York court. The irony of Victor Boot's situation is that between 2003 and 2005, he made tens of millions of dollars. One estimate put it at $60 million transporting equipment and ammunition and weapons into Baghdad for the United States Department of Defense. And so he was clearly used by the U.S. Department of Defense intelligence. government. And then it got to a point where he was no longer useful to them, and he perhaps was selling too much to insurgents and others in those sorts of conflicts. And they decided to arrest him and to try him. So it's a trade that is incredibly deceitful, that is full of hypocrisy, and sadly our own governments, including the government of the United States, is centrally involved in a lot of that hypocrisy and applies the law as and when it suits them.
You mention other countries that are also among the largest producers and acting, as you put it, almost like sales agents for these arms dealers. Russia, France, Germany, Holland, Sweden, Italy, Israel, and China. These are the ones you named.
And the United Kingdom.
Is it possible to break down the numbers and the regional influence according to these countries?
If we look at the United States, as I said, the U.S. is by far the most dominant player, accounting for just under 50% of the global trade in weapons. Europe would then come second to that and is fast being caught up by Russia and China. Russia, of course, or the former Soviet Union as it then was also a very big player during the Cold War. Not as big as American intelligence made out, but certainly the second largest player. That situation has dissipated significantly since the demise of the Soviet Union. A lot of the surplus Soviet equipment has been sold off by these illegal or black dealers, often in concert with the governments of the former Soviet states, the Ukraine in particular, which was the sort of weapons factory of the Soviet Union. China is the big growing manufacturer, selling an enormous amount, especially into Africa, into a lot of conflict zones, and I believe creating, intensifying and perpetuating a lot of those conflicts. If we look at some of the areas of conflict, the Sudan, the Darfur region, Somalia, where there is such a problem of piracy, there are an enormous amount of Chinese weapons being found in these areas. So the Chinese are the sort of emerging threat, and although in numerical terms they are not that big a player yet, they are becoming a larger and larger player. So something that I'm certainly looking at going forward. The second biggest player at the moment is the European countries, and amongst those, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom dominate. And the government of the United Kingdom in particular, since the time of Margaret Thatcher, has acted really as a salesperson in chief for the UK arms industry, and have tacitly condoned what continues to be an enormous amount of bribery and corruption. On the South African deal that we started this conversation with, DAE Systems, the British company, in order to win the largest contract, in which there was a massive amount of skullduggery. DAE were not even on the shortlist for this particular contract. The Defense Minister of South Africa insisted they were put on this shortlist. The South African Air Force announced publicly that they would only accept this jet from the British is forced to do so by the politicians, and it costs 2.5 times more than the jet that the Air Force actually wanted. But this British company paid 115 million British pounds in bribes on this one single deal. But this was a tiny percentage of the world's largest arms deal, which was between the UK and Saudi Arabia, something called the Al Yamamah deal, in which BAE Systems paid 6 billion British pounds in commission, the vast majority of which were just bribes.
We're speaking with Andrew Feinstein, and his book is called The Shadow World: Inside the Global Arms Trade. I'd like to talk a little bit about the effects of this whole system on societies, on democracies, and through its corruption, through its secrecy.
I think that there are multiple effects, the vast majority of which are negative. In over 11 years now of working on this area, I have yet to come across a substantial arms deal that isn't in some way tainted by illegality of one sort or another. And the corruption, the bribery, the making of inappropriate decisions, decisions that are not in the best interest of the countries buying the equipment, do undermine the very nature of our democratic system, the very way in which we are governed. We see enormous amounts of money being wasted on inappropriate weapons choices, no more so than in the United States today. We see the attempts to cover up the illegality or the poor decision-making leads to further undermining of our democratic institutions, sometimes the very rule of law. And the other very close relationship that I think is incredibly harmful to the way in which we are ruled is that the relationships between these companies and our governments are so close, are not open to the scrutiny of a normal industry, and nor are these industries regulated in anything like the way those industries that are regarded as harmful to our health, be it tobacco, alcohol, drugs, these are highly regulated industries. I would argue that the defense industry, which is involved in so much conflict and the loss of so much life, is also a danger to our health, but it's far less regulated than many of these other industries. So in these myriad ways, it not only intensifies and perpetuates conflict around the world, and also therefore informs the way in which we make foreign policy choices, which I would argue in the United States since the Reagan era, through all of the presidents since then, have favored the use of force rather than diplomatic means to resolve diplomatic disputes or issues. But they also ensure that there is a whole component of the way in which we are governed that we, as taxpayers, as voters, don't have full access to. And I think that that is also extremely harmful. But then, of course, the primary harm is in the numbers of conflicts that we're engaged in and the human suffering, both of our own citizens and people and those of other nations, that are a consequence of those conflicts.
You noted that President Carter had reduced this kind of expenditure more than any other president since 1951. But when we look now, say, at the Obama administration, what would be the motivation of leaders like Obama or like the ones in Great Britain, democratic leaders in European countries or wherever, to perpetuate such a system besides campaign contributions?
I think there's a political imperative in the sense that these companies do disperse significant amounts of money to political parties, to political candidates around the world. I think the second incentive relates to issues of national security, that no political leader wants to be seen as weak on national security, especially post the 9/11 tragedy, for obvious reasons. Then I think there is also what they see as the economic benefits, although I think those are often exaggerated. I think that they are not open to sufficient scrutiny. And those benefits, if the same amount of public money that is invested into the defense sector was invested into other manufacturing sectors, we could produce between 3 and 7 times more jobs for every dollar invested than is created in the defense sector and other sectors. But I think that because the industry is so powerful politically, that political leaders don't want to risk alienating the industry. If we look at the case of President Obama, when he was a candidate, he spoke about changing the procurement system, taking on the defense contractors. And one of the first things he did when he was in office, he introduced some new ethical guidelines to try and close down the revolving door, the movement of people between government, the defense establishment, the intelligence establishment, and the defense contractors. Within a matter of months of introducing those new ethical guidelines, his own administration violated them with a very major appointment of somebody who had been a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin for 25 years. And I think it was at that point that Obama, now as a new president, realized that he simply did not have the political capital to take on this incredibly powerful nexus of interest between the contractors, the military establishment, and lawmakers, and that he decided that this wasn't an issue that he was going to take on, although I would argue that in terms of the United States fiscal position, it's one of the most important things that he could do, which would be not in a radical way, but to reduce the levels of defense spending and ensure that the United States got far greater value for money in the defense dollars that it does spend. Because if we look just at the last 5 years, defense contractors have overspent on contracts awarded to them by almost $300 billion. Almost all of the equipment is delivered years, sometimes decades late. So there is a basic value for money question. But President Obama has felt that he simply does not have the political capital to take on what Eisenhower described as the military-industrial complex.
Do you see any potential solutions?
Researching and writing and campaigning on this area feels a little like banging my head against a brick wall. But the one thing that does give me hope at the moment is more people are starting to talk about this. the fact that my book is out there. This is the first book that has been published on the global arms trade in over two decades. The reality that many ordinary taxpayers, many voters are asking themselves whether their governments are actually working for them at the moment. So when they're asking whether they're getting value for money from their government, I think more and more people are starting to question the wisdom of the amounts of money that we are spending on these sorts of issues and the sorts of value that we are getting for this. And it would only require some quite small but very significant changes to be able to create an arms trade that is more transparent, more honest, and that actually contributes more meaningfully to our real national security rather than undermining that national security in the pursuit of profits and influence.
Andrew Feinstein is the author of The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. Thank you so much, Andrew Feinstein.
Thank you for having me on.
When we come back, how to improve international crime prosecution. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last month, the International Criminal Court accepted a complaint against British soldiers for systemic abuse, such as electrocution, mock executions, beatings, and sexual assault in Iraq. During the same month, the court sentenced a Congolese militia leader to 12 years in prison, completing its second conviction since the court was established 12 years ago. Just this week, the court announced it would step up its sex crimes prosecutions. What are the successes, failures, strengths, and weaknesses of the International Criminal Court? With us are two experts on international criminal prosecution. Hannah Gary is a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law and director of the International Human Rights Clinic. Chris Mani is a research fellow at the Center for International Law Research and Policy, a consultant at the Institute for Security Studies, Africa. He's the former deputy director of the New Zealand Center for Human Rights, Law, Policy, and Practice. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us here in the Scholar's Circle. I think there are something like 13 cases now before the ICC, but there haven't been many convictions. Hannah Gary, why do you think that is?
I think there's a number of reasons behind that. One big reason in my mind is that the court has been struggling with establishing its independence and its legitimacy as a criminal court. And so as a result, it's finding its way vis-a-vis states and its willingness to move forward and prosecute and to do so in a way that is acceptable to states' parties, but at the same time demonstrates its independence and its legitimacy. Another reason, I think, is a lack of cooperation from states' parties with respect to the prosecutor's office in gathering evidence, in bringing forward the cases, but then also internally some problems with leadership, particularly in the prosecutor's office over the years, but also court-wide. And then finally, initially, the court has been well-funded through the European Union, but with the recession, a lack of resources has also, I think, contributed to a slowdown in delivering efficient, effective justice.
Chris Mani, would you agree?
I would, broadly. The prosecution's been, to some extent, hamstrung by demand for an expansion in the number of situations that it examines, but not just examines, but investigates. And the fact that the expansion in its budget has not reflected the expansion in the number of situations that it's been requested to investigate. And the prosecutor actually said in the situation of Libya, we will be constrained in terms of what we can do unless we receive an increase in funding. And as Hannah rightly pointed out, the court has been trying to walk this tightrope between ensuring the political legitimacy of the court in terms of the reluctance or enthusiasm of states to cooperate with the court. and at the same time try to demonstrate some level of independence in terms of the extent to which the court is genuinely able to pursue those that bear the greatest responsibility for crimes. Now, if they demonstrate clear independence, but in doing so pursue cases that are politically sensitive, then they may not be able to apprehend and bring before the court those individuals because governments may be reluctant to actually cooperate with the court. And when that happens, of course, the court doesn't get their hands on the indictees, they don't hold the trials, and they don't conclude the cases. And that's really what's holding back the court.
So in terms of the two from the Democratic Republic of Congo, what are they telling us about the court? And would you consider them to be maybe successes for the court, Hannah Gary?
So first of all, with the Lubanga decision in 2012 and now the Katanga conviction in 2014, both have been somewhat criticized for the lower sentences in both cases, but also the types of convictions that have been reached. So in the Katanga case, a big criticism with regard to the events at Bagoro, not only did massacres take place there and horrible war crimes and crimes against humanity along the lines of murder and killings, but also a lot of sexual violence, which was not, you know, there were not convictions reached. And I think in both cases, with the convictions that the court was able to reach and the lower sentences, it demonstrates again that the prosecutor has struggled in bringing forward the case and having sufficient evidence to do so, and having the cooperation that is needed to bring those cases forward.
You're speaking of the sexual violence. These are supposed to be some of the worst sex crimes that the world has seen.
That's right. And the prosecutor's office under Bensouda has made it, to her credit, a priority to address these crimes. However, unfortunately, to date, we haven't seen convictions reached with regard to rape and sexual slavery and other crimes of sexual violence, where the evidence, at least from a public perspective and what we read in human rights reports, et cetera, is quite clear that these things have happened, but nevertheless, linking the accused to those crimes has proved very challenging for the court. I would note as well that the Katanga case is interesting in that it was previously joined with Ngujulo, who was acquitted at trial. Their cases were severed, and he was acquitted, and his case is now on appeal with regard to Bagoro. But if you look at the portions of the appeal that have been made public, it's quite clear that there has just fundamentally been a lack of evidence brought forward by the prosecution.
Chris Mani.
And that's to some extent been a consequence of an organization in its infant years, but also a demonstrated lack of capacity, particularly when you compare the capacity of the Office of the Prosecutor with, for example, the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. But I think what's even more concerning about the prosecutions that have occurred is the fact is those that have not. So Lubanga, for example, is very much a mid-level player. And the more important question, I think, is this court really able to pursue those that bear the greatest responsibility for the crimes in any respective situation? And in terms of the Congo, the prosecution really only focused on Ituri province. Just as many, if not more, crimes have occurred in North and South Kivu. And those crimes haven't been pursued by the prosecution. There was one case where they did pursue an individual, but it was, again, based on evidence provided by the United Nations mission in the Congo, as well as evidence provided by Human Rights Watch, and that was insufficient. So they hadn't really conducted their own sufficient independent investigations to substantiate the indictment. It was thrown out. But even more important is the question, where are the individuals from government that not only aiding and abetting, but in some cases commanding forces that have committed crimes? The Ugandan armed forces were in Ituri where investigations did happen and committed crimes. But then Mr. Lubanga led a militia that was supported by the Ugandan government. There's a wealth of literature and reporting on that fact, where the indictments of President Museveni or Salim Saleh from the Ugandan government, where are the indictments of actors from the Congolese government? And really the focus upon adversaries of governments in Africa, where the governments are the ones that have triggered the court's investigations, lends itself to the view that the court is a political instrument that governments are able to deploy against their adversaries, where governments have triggered investigations in the Congo, in Uganda, in the Central African Republic, and in Ivory Coast. There's a wealth of reporting on crimes committed by the governments in those situations. But the court has refrained from indicting any members of any government forces in any of those situations. And when you look at it also in the context of where the Security Council has triggered investigations, then they've gone after actors in the government, such as in Sudan and in Libya. And the court, sort of the prosecution, I should say, in particular, is setting itself up to be viewed as a political instrument as opposed to an independent entity pursuing those bearing the greatest responsibility, no matter what office they hold.
Hannah Gary, do you have the same kind of concerns that Chris Mani has expressed about the court?
Yes, I do. I think he raises a very important point, which is where we have situations and cases that have been imposed on particular states, such as Libya, such as Sudan, such as Kenya, where the prosecutor initiated the investigations in the case. We see that in those situations, the court is indeed attempting to bring cases against the highest level leaders responsible. But in situations where states' parties are referring, we have this problem of those bearing most responsibility not actually being indicted and tried. And so it is creating, I think, this impression that where the Security Council steps in and there's pressure from powerful states to go after the big guys, that the ICC responds to that pressure. Where there's pressure from states' parties, where they're referring cases to the court to only go after the scapegoats, it's responding to that pressure as well.
People refer to the International Criminal Court at times instead of other tribunals. One of the Libyan leaders is being asked to move to the International Criminal Court because he's saying he can't get a fair trial in the special tribunal. Hannah Gary?
In that al-Sisuni situation, that case all resulted from a referral by the Security Council of Libya to the International Criminal Court. And in accepting jurisdiction, the International Criminal Court had to, you know, consider whether the case was admissible and the trial chamber decided that with regard to al-Sisuni, it was not admissible because, in its view, the Libyan courts could actually try him fairly and try him with due process, and that they had initiated sufficiently investigations and were moving forward to prosecute him themselves. And so under the Rome Statute's complementarity principle, the court held off. However, that case is now being appealed, and very much the notion that Libya is actually capable as a country with its national court system, especially given recent events, that the situation has very much changed on the ground, and that in fact there's big question marks around how he's been treated in detention with torture alleged, and also, you know, he doesn't have an attorney, real lack of due process and upholding of his rights. So with that situation in Libya, it's not so much a question of referring him to another alternative sort of hybrid jurisdiction like we might see in Cambodia or elsewhere, but the question is whether or not he should be tried in his own courts in Libya under the ICC's complementarity scheme.
Chris Mani.
I think the hybrid courts have also demonstrated that they're particularly vulnerable to political manipulation as well. The Cambodia court, the government effectively informed the court that they were not to continue further investigations. In Sierra Leone, the prosecutor had to come back to the United States 3 or 4 times a year and request more money, and was told by the United States government not to pursue Gaddafi, not to pursue Blaise Compaoré, the president of Burkina Faso, to focus on Charles Taylor, because that court was set up as part of a regime change approach to Liberia by the U.S. Department of State. The situation in terms of Libya is one where we're starting to see how this whole principle of complementarity is playing out. And what we're coming to understand is that the complementarity threshold, i.e. what a government has to demonstrate in terms of being both able and willing to prosecute these crimes domestically, is incredibly low. And we're not just seeing that in Libya, but we're also seeing a dialogue that's coming out between the government of Colombia and the prosecution, where they've been exchanging letters and attempting to come to some form of agreement as to exactly what the Colombian government has to do to avoid the International Criminal Court opening a formal investigation in Colombia to crimes that have been committed. And what we're seeing is, in effect, the prosecution saying, well, we're going to accept a process in Colombia whereby you then commute the sentences, as long as that commutation is not to zero and we don't believe it's manifestly unjust, which is manifestly unjust being completely ambiguous in terms of how it's supposed to be interpreted right now, then we will accept the process that you pursue. Now, does that mean that the Colombian government, which has said it's going to employ this commutation of sentence for government-affiliated paramilitaries but not for the FARC because some of their abuses were involved with terrorism and narcotics, then they get to put their own people in a hotel for 2 or 3 weeks and then they let them go and they meet this complementarity threshold and the prosecution of the ICC doesn't investigate? I mean, that would render the court even more vulnerable to political manipulation. And I think that's what the African Union is setting itself up. They're endowing their own court. They're in the process of endowing it with jurisdiction over international crimes. So that means that African Union, as well as individual African governments, will be able to meet this complementarity threshold in terms of their own personnel and still have politicized trials, but still impose the ICC on their adversaries. And this whole principle, as it's so called, of complementarity is playing out not really as a principle that advances the interests of the prosecution of international crimes, but rather a mechanism for governments to be able to hold politicized trials domestically and still use the court where it's of political utility, not based on the merits applied to war.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking about the International Criminal Court and International Prosecution with Hannah Gary and Chris Mani. Now, both of you have mentioned Cambodia now, and I know, Hannah Gary, you actually were a legal advisor to the Supreme Court chamber there. Did it also have the same kind of flaws that you are talking about with the other courts? It's supposed to be giving its verdicts out in August.
If I could just jump off of a point that Chris has made, the flip side to what he's saying with regard to complementarity resulting in alternative jurisdictions and hybrid tribunals and regional courts such as we see being established in Africa, you know, that the result might be politicized trials in these alternative mechanisms. The positive side of the complementarity scheme is that with these alternative jurisdictions being established, that actually they potentially can be closing the accountability gap. Complementarity is indeed supposed to put pressure such that national legal systems, if they don't try in their own courts, that states would come together and perhaps set up these other alternative hybrid regional jurisdictions. But where the challenge is for the ICC, which Chris rightly notes, I think, is in making those firm decisions and having a firm hand when it's quite apparent that these alternative jurisdictions are being set up as sham trials, that they're merely victor's justice or some sort of politicized process. And in those situations, the ICC should be able to step in and say that it's clear that, you know, this is a situation of being unwilling to actually try these international crimes fairly with due process and in an unbiased, non-politicized way as much as possible. So I don't see the establishment of these alternative jurisdictions as necessarily a negative by any means, but actually a positive outcome of complementarity. The problem is that the court is really struggling, I think, in finding its way on when to assert jurisdiction, regardless of complementarity, where the circumstances require it to do so. With regard to Cambodia and the tribunal, it is also, you know, struggled equally or more, I think, than perhaps the International Criminal Court at the moment with legitimacy issues, with independence issues. It's been quite clear in cases 3 and 4 that there's been interference and lots of pressure put on the court from Hun Sen and his government. The court has also struggled with allegations of selective justice because it's quite clear that there are only certain members of the Khmer Rouge that are being tried, and hence why Hun Sen has been putting up a block with regard to any other indictments being brought forward. And so it is struggled with resources, and this particular hybrid model has made quite clear that we need to rethink the structure, particularly where they're placed in country, and think of more robust ways in which the court's independence can be protected and there can be more international monitoring of what's going on and assurances of the independence of the court. I think that in the final analysis, the ECCC, I think, was a good step forward for Cambodia as a whole, but it has certainly struggled with all of the problems we're identifying now vis-a-vis the ICC.
the other big weakness that is being shown now, particularly by Syria, is this whole process of how do you even refer from the Security Council when the world is divided or when there may be one veto that's divided out. What do we do about a situation like this, Chris Mani?
It signals the course for the court going forward is going to become more and more dependent on state referrals, not Security Council referrals, because from the perspective of the Russians and the Chinese, they felt like they learned a lesson in Libya where the situation there was referred to the ICC at a time when there was a matter of 300-400 deaths in that conflict. And as regrettable as those deaths are, within months of that referral, there was the report of the United Nations investigation on Sri Lanka that said tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people were killed in the Sri Lankan case, and that situation should be referred to the ICC for investigation. And the Security Council had never even tabled a resolution on that. And the Russians and the Chinese allowed the French, Americans and Brits to push through a resolution on Libya. That resolution led to another resolution to provide for a no-fly zone over Libya that was then elastically interpreted to provide for continued bombing and aggression against Libya because it was legal, but to achieve regime change. So whenever the Chinese and the Russians now kind of after drawing a line in the sand under Libya, they're very suspicious of the selective use of a Security Council referred situation, because they're saying, well, where's a Security Council referred situation in other instances, such as perhaps Yemen or Sri Lanka, for example? This is an instrument to try to drive a narrative that then justifies military intervention, because the real end goal here, you know, from their perspective, is regime change. And that's what they see in Syria. And it is concerning that you have these conflicts inflated by outside actors. So if you look at the Arab Spring sequentially at the start, you really had both in Syria and Yemen the same thing happening. You had people protesting on the streets and the security apparatus opening fire on those protests. The key difference is then you had the Qataris and the Saudis pumping people and weapons into Syria, which raised the scale of the conflict, and alongside that, the level of abuses. And then they can start citing, look at the abuses that are ongoing, we need to refer this situation to the International Criminal Court, and then you construct a narrative that justifies humanitarian intervention. So one has to ask the question, does this whole international law framework and the ICC's role in it incentivize nefarious actors to actually instigate or inflame conflicts in order to procure armed intervention that actually advances their interests in a particular country or region, as it would do for the Saudis or the Qataris, were regime change to happen in Syria, for example. So I don't think those kind of issues have really been fully thought through. The case of Syria is a tragic one because you have these chemical weapons attacks, but then you have one party to the conflict very quick to point the finger in terms of attributing responsibility for those attacks. And the other party, of course, saying, well, no, it wasn't us. And it's obviously not clear until you have an investigation who commits these attacks. But the power to actually attribute responsibility, whether that's proven or not, can have enormous consequences in terms of whether more powerful countries get involved in that conflict. And that can even raise the scale even further in terms of not just the conflict within Syria, but potentially outside across the region.
Hannah Gary, he's raised a lot of issues. Do you share these concerns?
I do. In fact, the other aspect of these Security Council referrals is the conditions that are often placed with respect to the referrals to the ICC, the conditions that are placed on the resolutions protecting powerful states. For example, the United States is a non-member state to the ICC, puts in a number of conditions to make sure that there are no prosecution of U.S. nationals. That certainly happened with the resolution that failed vis-a-vis Syria, but also there was limitations put on the resolution with respect to the Golan Heights to make sure that Israel was in no way going to be implicated as a non-member party state as well. And so the legitimacy of those cases being referred by the Security Council is further called into question because of the conditionalities that are placed on them. And Louise Arbour recently just spoke out on this very question of should we reconsider Security Council resolutions that refer to the International Criminal Court. And I think what's interesting is a push now, and this goes back to your point with respect to setting up alternative hybrid jurisdictions, but there has been some movement to try to set up a hybrid for Syria, not through the Security Council and not with Syria's consent, obviously, but through the General Assembly. And that's not normally how hybrid tribunals are established. The Cambodia Tribunal was established because of a request from the Cambodian government to the United Nations, the same for the Sierra Leone court and others. There's movements to try and get around this problem of the Security Council blocking justice from happening in non-member states like Syria, and one is going the route of the General Assembly. Now that calls into question a number of legal problems. It seems very problematic under the UN Charter whether the General Assembly has even the power to do this. But if it were somehow found to be legal, it would be interesting if there would be dilution of this politicization of referrals or of setting up of tribunals where you have more states involved in the question.
A while back, about 3 weeks ago, I think it was, there was an effort to try British soldiers for war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Given the power structures that you've been describing, would that ever occur, Chris Mani?
No, to be quite blunt, the prosecutor has investigated the alleged crimes of torture by the British government before. New evidence has been provided to the prosecution, and now they're reopening consideration of incidents of torture in Iraq. But the complementarity threshold is so low that it's very likely that were this to be pursued by the ICC, the British government could simply hold its own domestic proceedings that could be manipulated in a very subtle way, but still meet that complementarity threshold. That's exactly what Colombia has shown us. It's very easy, actually, to meet the complementarity threshold, especially when, like Colombia, you have a very powerful and well-endowed ally like the United States that's willing to provide tens of millions of dollars to support this process and make sure that it meets these technical elements. And particularly when, like in Colombia, U.S. culpability could come into question in terms of billions of dollars provided by the United States government and military aid to the Colombian government that was, of course, committing abuses itself. And, of course, much of the many accusations have been made against the United States government for committing torture. In fact, I know that Dick Cheney, you know, has said, yes, we ordered these methods, for example, waterboarding, you know, which almost all international lawyers would tell you. It's a clear breach of the Geneva Conventions. He said, yes, we ordered it. Yes, I think it was warranted. Yes, I'd do it again. But the more concerning thing about where international criminal law and international law generally is going is the simultaneous expansion of international criminal jurisdiction while the crime of aggression is being diluted. So there's a 1974 definition of the crime of aggression which in effect criminalized waging war by proxy. So sending people and arms to a militia engaged in a war in another country would constitute the crime of aggression, and that's been watered down since then. And the crime in the statute, in the Rome Statute, wouldn't necessarily be able to prosecute that. So here you have behavior, for example, with outside states pumping people and weapons into Syria, and that would have been criminal behavior a long time ago. Now it's legal. Not only is it legal, but it inflates the scale of the conflict to a level where people are calling for the Security Council to refer that situation for ICC prosecution. And when they begin to look at hybrid tribunals to address the case of Syria, I probably do not share Hannah's optimism in terms of the non-politicization of such a court. I'm sure you're not going to have the Iranians and the Syrians supporting such a court. It's going to be all the states who have geopolitical interest in seeing regime change in Syria proposing some kind of Arab League or Arab court to prosecute those crimes. And we've already seen evidence of that in terms of the investigations that was composed into torture. And it was funded by Qatar. You know, one of the supporters of one of the parties to the conflict in Syria funds an investigation into torture committed only by one party to the conflict, the Syrian government, not into any crimes committed by the armed groups fighting against the Syrian government, and also led by at least two former prosecutors that have held conflicts of interest in terms of their former history, one being Deputy Prosecutor and then Chief Prosecutor of the Special Court, Esmond de Silva, who worked with the former President of Sierra Leone, Ahmed Tidjane Kabah, who the Truth and Reconciliation Commission found culpable for the crimes committed by the Government Aligned Militia, played exactly the same role as Charles Taylor did in supporting that militia and was never pursued for those crimes. And the same thing with David Crane, and there was another member of that investigation who conducted an investigation paid for by the Ghanaian government into crimes that were committed in Guinea and found the Ghanaian government to not be culpable for those crimes, despite subsequent UN investigations showing the absolute opposite. I'm certainly not optimistic that any hybrid court focused on Syria will be seriously considered independent.
Hannah Gary.
On the British question, Britain has put together a prosecutorial team. It was in 2010 that is supposedly conducting investigations into Iraq and the allegations there. And again, I think it's a positive, actually, step that the prosecutor's office at the International Criminal Court is taking in reopening preliminary investigations because of communication from various human rights groups with new information coming forward about the systematic nature of torture allegedly conducted by the British troops. I do think that because of complementarity, it really, the question is before the International Criminal Court that if the prosecutor does consider this matter and decide to move forward, that it really should, you know, think about asserting more its independence and establishing its legitimacy by applying a more robust standard for complementarity. And if, you know, indeed in the last 4 years in these investigations nothing has happened and it's clear that nothing in terms of prosecutions in Britain of any substantial nature will happen, that the court should be willing to step forward even with respect to a powerful state like the United Kingdom and say, look, you're unwilling here. It's clear in the way you've conducted your investigations, and we will assert jurisdiction and find these cases admissible.
Chris Mani and Hannah Gary, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Hannah Gary is a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law and director of the International Human Rights Clinic. Chris Mani is a research fellow at the Center for International Law Research and Policy, a consultant at the Institute for Security Studies, Africa. He's the former deputy director of the New Zealand Center for Human Rights, Law, Policy, and Practice. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper, Nankine Agassian, and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.